ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
He was the man who stole the plans for the atomic bomb. A brilliant physicist, a devoted communist. A spy hiding inside the most secret project on Earth. This is the story of Klaus Fuchs, a man who believed he could serve two masters, science and the Soviets. To hear it, search for The Bomb on the ABC Listen app.
Hi, I'm Tegan Taylor and this is Life Matters, where your stories shape the national conversation. It's already 2026, but before it kicks off properly, I'm revisiting some of your favourite stories from last year. Today, we'll be discussing what happens when a couple is having trouble conceiving. Why does attention gravitate towards the woman when male fertility contributes up to 50% of cases? It carries stigma and misconceptions, but new guidelines are aiming to change that. Also coming up, could you imagine having a romantic relationship with a chatbot? One in seven Aussie adults think they could. And now getting explicit with a bot is a whole lot easier. It's all coming up here on ABC Radio National. But first, one of the biggest celebrity stories of 2025 was the news that Nicole Kidman and Keith Urban had ended their marriage after 19 years. It came as such a shock to many people, as did the rumours that Keith had reportedly moved on with a new relationship. We're talking two global superstars here, but in a lot of ways, they were also going through a pretty relatable experience because about 30% of Australian marriages end in divorce. Many people go on to find new partners and remarry. So what's the best timeline to embark on a new beginning? Well, Kate Halfpenny is a journalist and author who's written about endings and beginnings in her own relationships. Kate, welcome back to Life Matters.
Oh, Tegan, thank you for having me. I always love chatting to you.
Same. Well, let's talk about relationships. We're just diving straight in today. Your first marriage ended when you were in your 40s. You've been together for decades. What was it like to end such a long relationship?
Devastating. anyone who tells you otherwise, I think, is, you know, well, actually, I won't say that. In my case, I found it super excruciating, and I've said it before that it is like, as Drew Barrymore put it, being dragged nude up and down a giant cheese grater. It's that level of agony, and I wouldn't wish it on anyone. I was sort of taken by surprise with it. You know, I'd kissed my husband for the first time when we were 17 on Surfers Paradise Beach, and we'd been together through all the teens, 20s, 30s and midway into our 40s and had three children and what I thought was a lovely life. But it did end, and it was really, really hard sort of looking ahead to thinking what happens next. And this is going to make me sound really shallow, but one of the, you know, I remember sobbing with him on our stairs in the kids' playroom and just saying, who am I going to go on holidays with? And, you know, it sounds really dicky when I say it, but I think that that's the sort of thing that you think, you know, what I was trying to say is, am I ever going to have someone else in my life? Like, has the opportunity for love now passed me by? Have I used up my one chance? That was how I was feeling, and I think that's not uncommon.
That's such a poignant thing to say, because I think what you're really saying is who am I going to share my life with?
Right, exactly right. And that, you know, that for me was sort of our special time when we would say goodbye to the kids for 2 weeks a year and go off by ourselves. And I don't know, like that was sort of what hit me. I mean, there's tons of other things that I see in this, but that was just sort of the thing for me. Like, will someone love me again, you know? And certainly at that stage, 46, bit of an old war horse, you know, tons of dings on the bodywork and, you know, with three children as well. And, you know, we had built a life together. It's not just that I think the thing is that in a marriage, you're not just a couple. You might have kids, you're a family, and your friends are a part of that. You know, everyone I think is invested in what I call, certainly, you know, if we look at Keith and Nicole, I call that brand Keith and Nicole. And I felt that very much, you know, once you do separate or split up, everyone around you goes into a little bit of free fall too, because they're, the breakup affects everyone.
Did you have an, like, you obviously had that moment of going, like, am I ever going to feel love again? Did you have a sense of how long you would need or how long you might think was the right amount of time to not be with someone?
That's such a great question. No, I think taken at that stage, you know, I was just thinking how to get from day to day. And what I used to do was fill up my bath and get into it, into a boiling hot bath. And then I'd sit in there for an hour. And then when it was cold, I would think, I've survived another hour, I'm okay. And I'd heat it up again. So I would just, you know, that was my way of getting through the day. And so that, it was that level of distress. So I certainly wasn't thinking, oh, I'm on the lookout for my next fella. And I really did think that maybe I'd had my great love and that my life from that time on would be family and friends. And that was okay too. Certainly it's an adjustment. But I think for everybody, you want to know that there is someone out there in the world for you who is your person.
Well, anyone who's listened to Life Matters closely over the last few months and has a good memory knows that you did meet someone else. You're married to Chris now. How long did it take for you guys to get together?
Okay, so we're moving from me sobbing and saying, I haven't got anyone to go on holiday with, to telling Chris I loved him on our first date, which was 6 weeks after my husband left me. I know. Like, I've got to be honest about it. It doesn't sound bad. It sounds really terrible. But, you know, you and I, Tegan, our conversations are always honest, and I will keep that up with you. Yeah, it was 6 weeks. My brother said, you know, look, you need to have a good time. I'm going to call up this fellow that you might remember from school days. And so we went out for dinner, and that was with my now husband, Chris. But, yeah, it was only 6 weeks. But I knew immediately that he was – I knew immediately that I was in love with him. And it's a really tricky thing because, you know, some family and friends hated it. And Tegan, looking back, I can see why, because it was super fast. But at the same time, I knew that I'd fallen in love with this man who would become my husband. And I really trusted that feeling, even if the timing made everyone else uncomfortable. You know, I do understand why people struggle with quick repartnering. When I think back, you know, I think, wow, how would I have felt if it was someone in my circle? So I know that it can look like you've dismissed or disrespected the old relationship and that you're trying to paper over heartbreak, you know, with a shiny new love. And certainly my sons very much felt that way. One of them said to me, you know, one day you never loved Dad at all. And, you know, that was his take on it just because I had found this new person. But, you know, in my case, it wasn't about filling a gap. It was about recognizing something real and something lovely and something really precious, even if it came sooner than anyone expected, you know, most of all, my good self.
This is Life Matters on ABC Radio National. I'm Tegan Taylor. I'm speaking with Kate Halfpenny, who's sharing the story of seeing a long-term relationship crumble and mourning that and then quite quickly finding a new relationship. And I'd love to know your stories on whether there's an ideal time to move on with a new partner after the end of a relationship, if you've tested the time limits. And listening in on our conversation, Kate, is Elizabeth Shaw. She's a clinical psychologist and CEO of Relationships Australia, New South Wales. Elizabeth, welcome back to Life Matters.
Hi, Tegan, and hi, Kate. What an extraordinary story.
I know. Are you horrified by it?
Well, I think it's a delightful story because it's so human. It's got every emotion in it, hasn't it? It's you know, devastation and heartbreak and hope and celebration, you know, and life is messy and you don't always plan any of these things because we're human and we sort of stumble about and have to get through somehow. So you sound like you embrace the opportunities that came along amidst all that despair.
Thank you so much for saying that because, you know, there is that part of me that's always thought, was I filling a void rather than running to, you know, rather than embracing this beautiful new opportunity? But it's 13 years on now, so I think that, you know,
I think you've proven your own point, haven't you?
Yeah, totally. But I love hearing you, the expert, saying it. Thank you so much.
Well, look, I think everyone would initially think, is it a flight into hope, you know? And so what if it had been? I mean, what if you had done that and it lasted 6 weeks, but it actually gave you a sense, actually, there are things in my future. And, okay, it wasn't this one, but it shows that there are people out there and I, you know, I can start to picture how that could look. That's also potentially a valuable experience, you know, and you can also meet someone and slow down and, you know, say, I have met someone, it looks right, but I'm going to take the next few months to prove that. I mean, there's, you know, there's a lot of stretchiness about that phase. But yes, 13 years on, you've proven your original point, but it must have taken a long time for people to believe you.
Well, absolutely. And that was one of my fears, that people would look at it only as, oh, this is a rebound thing and she's, you know, she's grasping at straws. Whereas I knew in my heart from that very first date when I did tell my husband that I loved him, it took him a week to say it back though, which I think is quite telling. But, you know, I didn't want people to see it just as a gap filler, because I felt very strongly from the first that he was super important and in a lot of ways my great love.
Elizabeth, I'd love to ask you about that, that feeling of when to trust your gut when you're in a state of real grief. And like Kate, sort of like she knew it in her heart. But I think sometimes in those periods of our lives, you're not a trustworthy witness to yourself. How do you know when it's real, like what we're seeing with Kate, and when it's maybe your emotions just in this state of flux?
I think you can register that in that moment it feels important, it feels worth pursuing. And the question is more, how do I keep myself steady? And who can I have in my corner to work with me on this while I work it out? So I think to be able to say, okay, my emotions are volatile and it could be any number of things right now. It's feeling pretty good, but it could be any number of things. So then I think you know, when you enter a new life stage, you often need a very different group of people around you. So say if you've been in a very, very settled friendship group, you may need to meet new people to try and work out, though, who can be steady with you, which is quite different to who's going to cheer you on or who's going to go out drinking with you. It's who can help you think straight. They're not naysayers, but nor are they falsely amplifying feelings.
Kate, you were with Jay for decades, like you said before, and then you mentioned before that your brother introduced you to Chris, but like you knew him from school as well. It sounds like you're in a group, a fairly tight-knit group. How did that affect how people responded to your relationship changes?
I think that people were devastated. You know, they mourn the loss of this couple that they've known unselfishly. You know, they do very much feel for you. But at the same time, I think there is somehow that sort of underlying feeling of what does this do to the friendship group? And how does this affect my own relationship? Like, is this contagious?
You know,
right. Has one domino fallen and another one fallen? You know, people I think that there are a lot of people who were in free fall at the loss of this, and people saying to me, you'll get back together. You can, you know, this is just a short-term thing. And I found the responses really interesting. Instead of saying, as my mum did, I think this is over, I think it's done, and I think that you need to move on now. Lots of people were sort of in a state of disbelief, because I think that they grieve, friends grieve the relationship. You know, they've invested in your story as a couple, and it can make them question their own sense of security in love. I did have that feeling from a few people.
Elizabeth, this idea of contagion, I feel like I've heard about this, especially for couples in their 40s. Is there anything to it?
Look, absolutely. I think Kate's describing this just so very well, that absolutely if you're in a settled group, and you know, many people are really fortunate around that they can think, well, actually, I thought you were happier than us, you know, and I would have picked that you'd be the ones that would last. And if, in fact, you've been together a very long time and it looks like someone has found, the grass is greener, it can make people question that, because some think they would never disrupt because they're happy enough. They wouldn't be confident alone. They'd be afraid of not finding someone else. So some people, they're not questioning their relationship for a whole lot of reasons. That might just be a fleeting thought they have, about 10% or 20%, from on a bad day. But I think when another couple proves that separation might happen, and in fact other options are out there, I think the mid-40s, that's where we do see relationships more vulnerable, around those teenage years, late primary school. That is a common time. And then another time is when the children have reached adulthood, that consciously or unconsciously people wait till the end of school. And so, I think there are really disruptive times, and it is a lot to work through, including things like loyalty. Whose side am I supposed to be on? And a lot of that is really sorted according to the ambassadorship of the couple that are separating, because if they do it in a dignified, amicable way and they want friendships to be kind and preserved, then that gives leadership to the rest of the friendship group. But if there's a real sort of, guns adorn kind of separation, then people, particularly long-standing friends, really flounder as to where they're meant to fall in behind the other.
Mm. On Life Matters, it's on ABC Radio National. I'm Tegan Taylor speaking with Elizabeth Shaw from Relationships Australia, New South Wales, and Kate Halfpenny, who's a journalist and author who's written a lot about her long-term relationship ending and a new great love sparking. And I'd love to hear from you this morning as to if you think there's an ideal time frame to move on with a new partner after the end of a relationship. And we're talking also about sort of the ideal time frame to leave after perhaps a relationship ends. And Helen says, I've been with my partner for 30 years. We're happy, but I'm terrified. Can we be together forever? Does that still happen? Elizabeth, is this an anxiety that you hear often?
Not so much. I must say people may not sort of state that. I think when relationships are in difficulty, depending on how long that's been going along, people can obviously get very worried. But it's also amazing how tolerant people are of problems. I'll see couples where one has said they need to leave the relationship and the other would be saying, what the hell, I know we fight from time to time, or I know we haven't had sex for 12 months, or I know you seem very distracted, but I never would have thought it's come to this. I think oftentimes couples, in a useful way, will dismiss some issues going along as a bad week, as work stress, and in fact tolerate a lot of behaviours because they feel so secure, instead of actually working on these as they come up. And I'm not saying all of those things are warning signs, because it is the strength of a settled couple that you don't panic, that you don't jump at shadows all the time. That would be a very anxious, ridden relationship. At the same time, that same story down the track, when one person says, I need to leave the relationship, that same story, which is all the things that we did overlook, actually have been part of being almost too secure or too unwilling to look at the threat that was emerging, and all those missed opportunities can make the partner left behind feel really ripped off that they didn't get to work on those things.
Kate, what about you thinking about this idea of, like, do people really stay together forever? Having seen a long-term loving relationship break down and you've managed to find a beautiful love again, do you believe in lifelong love? Do you think that that's something you're aiming for, or is that not as relevant?
No, I'm absolutely aiming for that, Tegan. And, Elizabeth, I don't know if you hear this from people that you speak to, but I still, 13, 14 years on, I still mourn that first marriage, while absolutely honouring and giving everything I have to the second and final one. But I've got really great role models. My parents have been married for 65 years. My big sister's been married for 43 years, I think. I look at them and I think I would love to have had what you have. And I'm not even sure why that is, because I know that both of those marriages are not perfect, but they're secure and they're stable and they're constant and they're there, they exist, you know, they've survived. And I really love that. And I would have loved to have had that legacy, I think, certainly for my children. You know, they are still the people in this that I think, oh, look, mum got to go on to a second happy love story, but they don't get another family. And now I'm going to get, I feel like every time I talk to you, Tegan, I start crying, which is hilarious. We're going to have to go out one day for a bottle of wine and I won't cry. You know, like I do, I feel that. I feel confident that I can have this eternal, enduring love story second time around. I feel confident that I've found that. But as I say, what I can't do is reverse, you know, the damage for my children and give them back the complete family.
Elizabeth, do you have advice for people who are looking at this in their own lives and going, how do I navigate this? How do I protect all the different people I want to protect?
Look, there's probably two things that I would point to. One is that there's plenty of relationship research now that does say that separation per se does not have to in itself be damaging. Of course, it's disruptive and painful and all of those things. But the biggest thing that is going to harm children and adults is long-standing conflict, really, really bitter, nasty conflict that implicates the children and where they feel their loyalty's torn and they're not free to love both parents. Those things are very harmful to children. But I think seeing parents struggle and be dignified and be respectful and bring everyone on the journey, there's a lot of learning in that, because the research says too that people are far more likely to have at least two or three, maybe four very significant relationships across their lifespan. Now, that may not be that many marriages if people even choose to marry, but certainly we can expect that. The other thing is that I think being respectful of bringing people on the journey, informing them of where you're up to, giving them their own space to have their own feelings, not just imposing a new partner and saying, this is your new dad, you've got to love them too. You know, I think it's how you do this and respect that everybody has their own thoughts and feelings and investments. And that even though you're the adult, it actually doesn't mean you can control all the participants. And I think too, even if you found someone very quickly, just making sure that the introductions and you know, the way things play out do follow the timeline of everyone. So you're not at the behest of children where they get to control, you can't have someone move in for 10 years. But at the same time, you don't say, I've just met them and in 2 weeks they're moving in. You know, there's somewhere between these things. That are more responsible ways to manage it.
Kate, Elizabeth, it's always such a pleasure speaking to you both.
Thanks.
Thank you both, ladies. Kate. You're absolute rippers. Thank you, Elizabeth.
Kate Halfpenny is a journalist and author. Elizabeth Shaw is a clinical psychologist and CEO of Relationships Australia, New South Wales. And thank you for your texts as well. One says, I've experienced this contagion effect observing my parents' generation. It seemed once kids reached an age ending school, there seemed to be a common breakdown in relationships that I had always viewed as very solid. Peter's written in saying, I was with my wife for 6 years. During that time, we separated twice before the final breakup. I made the decision that we should separate again, and that should we separate again, that will be it. I didn't repartner for 3 years and I waited 9 months before introducing my partner to my children. Peter ends saying, the grass isn't always greener on the other side of the fence. Well, coming up here on Life Matters on ABC Radio National, new recommendations are set to change the way doctors approach infertility.
On ABC Radio National,
the arts aren't just entertainment.
They're part of who we are.
Andy Griffiths.
He ended up at the centre of the earth fighting the peanut butter beast.
Now, Ben O'Cree.
Put their hands up if they have never been brokenhearted.
The changing nature of performance and recording in Australia.
From books to music and far beyond, the arts are just one way Radio National
explores the world in full.
Infertility is a tough topic at the best of times, but when it comes to male infertility, the stigma can have big consequences for starting a family because fertility is often viewed as a, and I'm using air quotes here, a woman's problem. It's the view of many in the community, but also in the medical profession. Well, new guidelines aim to change this. They're actually the first Australian guidelines to inform how doctors approach male infertility. So today, we're talking about it because even with the guidelines, we need to remove the stigma. And you'll hear from the lead author of those recommendations very shortly. But first, Jason Wiley's story of infertility is one that he's keen to share. Jason, welcome to Life Matters.
Thank you for having me, Tegan.
So when did you start to go, oh, no, something's happening. We're not, we maybe have an infertility journey that we're on here.
We started to try and conceive about a year into being married, and then it took. Everyone sort of said, "Oh, it'll take some time. Don't stress. You know, it's a process." So probably about a year in, we were like, "Okay, we need to go and have some conversations." So my wife initially got checked, and it came back that everything was all clear and fine on her side of things. So then it was my turn to go to the GP and get a referral to have my sperm checked, and that came back really low. So then we're like, oh, wow, what's next? What do we need to do? And we were sort of said, well, this is the IVF is the path to go, and away you go. Here's your referral. So that was sort of our first step of like, okay, things aren't going to be easy for us.
And then what happened? You started going through IVF?
Yeah, so we were initially, yep, get checked again. So then you have to go through and get your checked by the IVF sperm facility. So we did that. Yep, you're low. This is your option. This is what you have to do. Let's get started straight away. And we were still fairly young. You know, we're in our early 30s at this stage. So we decided that it was best for us to actually pause and take some time to say, well, this isn't the right time for us, and let's come back when it is the right time. So this was in sort of 2018. We decided to actually start again in 2020 and start that process again. So we had to go through all the checks again and all the tests again, but we felt like we were more ready to do that process and more mentally prepared. And then, yeah, it was the same results. So we were off to get all the drugs, and that was probably really heavy on my wife's side rather than for me. You just sort of stand off to the side and wait for your turn if you do need to freeze some sperm or have some stuff ready on the day. But, yeah, I was a real bystander in that process for a long period of time.
And then you got a good surprise.
Yeah, we did, yeah. So we sort of thrived in COVID. I think we were both working from home, we're eating well, exercising really well and really in a great space. And so we actually ended up conceiving naturally. So my wife, Elise, was ready to inject the drugs when her period came, as the process is, but that never came. So we'd fallen pregnant naturally. And when we went back to the IVF doctor, she was really surprised and shocked. And I retested my sperm and she's like, you're at, you know, a normal rate. Not sure what happened. And these things can happen because there was, as she sort of said, there's not a lot of information in male infertility and they really don't know a lot of the answers from time to time. So, yeah, it was a really nice surprise. So we never actually really had to do much the first time round when we conceived.
So you've got this beautiful little bub, wonderful result. You start trying for a second child naturally, you had to go back to IVF, and you were saying that in this whole process you felt like a bit of a bystander. What happened to sort of shift the focus back onto you?
Yeah, so part of having low sperm is you have to get regular checks on your testicles because you might be you're sort of a precursor, I think is my understanding, for something else to happen. So you might have calcifications or maybe a testicular cancer or something like that. So I was getting regular checkups and ultrasounds, and the guy doing the ultrasound one day said, "You've got a really large bag or seal here, and like that can be removed." And
what's, I was like, "Oh, sorry, what's that word you just said?"
Vagus seal. I think Dr. Katz, when he's on, will probably say it a bit better. But from my understanding, it's like a vagus vein in your testicles that's quite large, and there's a lot of tissue around the vein. So he's like, yeah, if it ever painful, like you can get it removed. And mine wasn't necessarily providing a lot of discomfort or anything. I just thought, oh, okay. And then that was in my notes And then I mentioned it to my GP and he's like, yeah, you could look into that. But he's like, I'm not an expert in that area. So yeah, maybe you could. And it wasn't until we did a couple of rounds of IVF that were unsuccessful. Our egg quality was really low. My wife was having some issues with the reactions to the drugs in the process. We unfortunately had an ectopic pregnancy as part of the process as well, which was really hard to work through. That we started, my wife started speaking to a fertility nurse and she said, I really think you should explore this further, the vagus seal and what you can do there. So we found another doctor, Dr. Rob, who then referred us on to Dr. Katz, who was able to sort of say, yeah, this is something you can actually get removed and it can impact on male infertility. So that was the sort of process we went through in the short version.
So you had the surgery, spoiler alert, you have two boys. Congratulations.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah.
You really sort of IVF, as you're alluding to, it's the physical burden's very much on your wife. And what I'm also hearing in your story is just the drip of time elapsing in a phase of life that time is really of the essence.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think from the start, you know, about a 7-year period for us to have two sort of successful pregnancies, both being natural, but having to go through this emotional and stressful toll of what IVF was, when, you know, if we'd known more earlier, we really could have avoided that whole journey. I don't think we certainly would never change our outcome of our two beautiful young boys, but we would certainly not want to be involved in that process if we could.
Yeah. Well, that's part of the aim of new guidelines that have recently been released to focus a bit more on male infertility. You are listening to Life Matters on ABC Radio National. I'm Tegan Taylor. That's Jason's story. One text says that doctors always do often invasive tests on the woman first. Simple, non-invasive sperm check would be good for the first investigation. Also, the woman often feels that it's her fault. Well, with me is Associate Professor Darren Katz. He's a urologist and a male fertility specialist, and he's one of the experts responsible for these new guidelines. And Darren, you're actually, Jason's one of your patients as well.
No, he is. And thank you to Jason for being so brave and telling his story. I mean, a lot of men suffer in silence with this problem. And thank you so much, Jason, and also you, Tegan, for airing this incredibly important topic, which I'm very, very passionate about, and that is male infertility.
Yeah, I mean, listening to Jason's story, I'm imagining it's not an uncommon story that you're hearing at your clinic.
No, I hear it time and again, and there are several touch points in his fertility journey which are very relevant to these new guidelines. The first thing, and it's which you've said and it's come up again with your listeners and also with Jason, is that when a couple presents for infertility, you're right, it's always the female that's sent off for a whole gamut of testing. She's investigated. That can be a long delay, unnecessary tests sometimes. And then eventually someone says, well, everything's normal. Maybe we should check the male. And then you just happen to find a problem. Tegan, in Australia, one in six couples are suffering from infertility. And in 50%, there's a male factor which contributes to that couple's infertility. And in 30%, it is the sole cause. So this is such an incredibly, unfortunately, common problem, but something that can really is important that patients and doctors managing fertility appreciate that there's help out there for lots of guys in Australia.
I'd imagine that given that there does seem to be this imbalance in at least the way people understand male infertility, that even getting people into your clinic is a challenge.
No, look, it is. And unfortunately, there is a bit of a stigma around infertility. I've published some papers on this where the psychological impact of male infertility on a patient, it's a real hit to a patient's masculinity. But it really shouldn't be. This is a common problem. And part of these guidelines is really just to try and raise awareness that this is a problem, that there is help out there for guys. And it shouldn't be something that they should be, as Jason said, it was put in a corner, he felt like a bystander. It shouldn't be like that. This is a couple's problem. Couples should be treated together. And in fact, one of our first guideline statements, i.e. one of the first recommendations, there are 80 in these first ever guidelines, is that when a couple presents to a doctor for infertility, both the male and the female should be assessed concurrent at the same time. So incredibly important, simple, and I think will have a profound change into how male infertility is managed in Australia.
So these guidelines, like you say, they're extensive. They're mostly for doctors, but for people who are needing them, what sort of care should they expect? What sort of things should they feel entitled to ask for?
So it's quite simple. I think if the take-home messages are is that this is often a couple's problem. In half the time, it can be a male factor. So the simple thing to do is if you, as a couple, present to your doctor with infertility, I think the first thing to do is to ask for a semen test, because that's often a big window into a male's fertility potential. And that should be, that is the first thing that I think a patient should be asking.
What do you hope these recommendations achieve?
So, look, when I first went and did a subspecialty training in America, I went to a place called Cornell, which is a major male fertility centre in New York. And there I realised there were just so many sort of advancements in male infertility that I didn't even know of or came across here during my training. So I brought some of these back to Australia, some of these sort of, you know, advanced techniques and operations and different approaches for treatment of male infertility. And I slowly began to try and sort of change the way that male infertility was managed in Australia. But to be honest, trying to change entrenched practices of doctors in medicine is actually quite difficult. And I think one of the reasons for that, Tegan, is because male infertility in this country can be fragmented, and the same patient presenting with the same problem can often have inconsistent care. And when we compare ourselves to Europe and in America, both of these continents have well-established guidelines that medical practitioners can call on. These have been around for over 20 years now, and they are serially updated. These are all evidence-based. So about 3 years ago, a panel of experts got together, and a big shout-out to them. Honestly, Tegan, this was a team effort. There were six other experts on this panel, and without them, these guidelines would have never come to fruition. And we got together, and we started to develop these first-ever Australian guidelines for managing infertility. So there are, as I mentioned, there are 80 of them. They're all evidence-based. And importantly, they're all endorsed by key stakeholder organisations throughout the infertility arena. They're endorsed by the Urological Society of Australia and New Zealand, of which I'm a part of. They're endorsed by the Fertility Society of Australia and New Zealand, which are the IVF specialists. Also, they're endorsed by the Endocrine Society of Australia, as well as Healthy Male, which is funded by the Australian Department of Health. And they actually really provide a lot of the background support and help and led the charge in this important endeavour. And because they're endorsed by key stakeholder organisations, I think this is going to be really a game changer, because they're going to be widely adopted and a game changer as to how male infertility moving forward will be managed in our country.
Darren, thank you so much for joining me today. Associate Professor Darren Katz is a urologist and male fertility specialist. He's the lead author of these new guidelines on male infertility. And thank you also to Jason Wiley for sharing your story. Next here on Life Matters, why more and more people are turning to AI chatbots for intimacy, romance, and friendship.
She was warm, funny, every student's favourite teacher.
No one ever suspects a woman could do such a thing, especially one with kids.
The parents trusted her too.
I felt that the school was a safe place. If anything was to happen, there would be somebody there.
But it was all a smokescreen.
She was brainwashing her from the start.
The Favourite, a five-part investigation from Background Briefing. Search Background Briefing on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
How do you feel about striking up an erotic conversation with the world's most popular AI chatbot? Yes, ChatGPT wants to step out of the friendship zone and take your relationship to the next level. OpenAI says the new version of ChatGPT also includes the ability to act like a friend. It's the latest move in a world that's increasingly using AI for intimacy, romance, and friendship. A new YouGov survey found 1 in 7 Australian adults could imagine falling in love with an AI chatbot. Other respondents said they would sometimes rather stay at home and speak with a chatbot than go out with friends. So what happens if our companions, lovers, and friends are made of code? Is it innovation? Can a bot help alleviate loneliness? Or are there too many risks when you replace human connection with AI? Well, with me is Professor Jeannie Patterson, co-director of the Centre for AI and Digital Ethics at the University of Melbourne. And Scott Waters is CEO and founder of the Youth Mental Health Service Life Changer. Jeannie, I might start with you. What's your understanding of these new ChatGPT functions?
Interestingly, ChatGPT, we've heard in the news that a lot of young people are using ChatGPT for companionship. We know that there's lots of commercial products providing companionship. ChatGPT has, or OpenAI has announced they're going to have a special ring-fenced age-verified option for people to engage in erotic conversations with a chatbot.
That is something you can already do with other chatbots that are around, right?
It certainly is. A number of the inverted commas companion bots will engage in erotic conversations. Replica is probably the most well-known of those. And I think Grok will also engage in erotic conversations. That being said, there's been a lot of move around the world, in Australia, in England, even in the US, to kind of clean up access to harmful conversations with sort of free chatbots or companion bots. And so there's been a bit of a push to clean up the market. So it's perhaps not surprising that if you're going to introduce erotic content, you'd put it behind age verification.
So on one hand, we're cleaning up the market. On the other hand, we're sort of expanding what it's allowed to do. Oh,
yes,
Jeannie, there's so many questions I have about this. I guess, how do you age verify it? What's safe? What's not safe? I mean, from your perspective, what are your key concerns, or do you think it's a good thing?
Look, my key concern is that I'm really interested in the possibility of digital mental health developed by mental health professionals that will help address the fact that we have a high rate of poor mental health, particularly in young people. This has been tracked by a number of our mental health services, and they can't get access to therapists. And it's possible we could use digital technology really to provide some of that early stage support. But instead, we've got the race to the bottom, where we've got more and more chatbots either providing utterly inappropriate content, failing to pick up on not subtle signs of self-harm, but blatant signs of self-harm. And now we're going to encourage young people who may be lonely not to respond to that loneliness, perhaps becoming more engaged in their community, but lose themselves in a virtual world of erotic chatbots. And as for the age verification, well, we know the troubles with that, yeah, with our social media ban.
So, Scott, you're with Life Change, which is a youth mental health service. That's one of the key things that Jeannie's just mentioned there. Your teams are seeing a big spike in people mentioning AI companions during your workshops.
Yeah, morning. Morning, Tegan. Morning, Jeannie. Without doubt. I mean, in the last 2 years in particular, one of the questions we ask in some of our workshops, and this is with about 140,000 young people last year, so it's a large volume of evidence, is we question them around their village, their community, and what that looks like. And we noticed, and obviously that includes parents, that includes mentors, teachers, coaches, etc., that about 2 years ago, what was coming into that conversation was included in that network or that community or that village was AI chatbots. So to have that mentioned as and being described as a relationship was, at first, it was actually quite alarming when we're hearing 13, 14, 15-year-olds discussing that, yeah, chatbots are part of that relationship now. So I think the concerns and the comprehensive framework that's needed to make sure that this is safe, because digital interaction isn't the enemy, it's what that interaction actually is, the content. But particularly when you're dealing with young people, when against the backdrop of, you know, suicide remains the biggest killer of young people in the age of 15 to 24. And there is a risk here that, not regulated the right way, AI companions, it shares harmful content, it can distort reality, it can provide advice that is counterproductive and dangerous. You know, it can encourage an ongoing interaction that leads to addiction, overuse and dependency. And at an age, particularly with young people, where they haven't really developed fully their critical thinking, they can be misguided and manipulated. So The most important thing for people, and this is medical fact, is the quality of their social interactions. That's what leads to a long and meaningful life. And I'm yet to be convinced that the regulations and frameworks are going to guarantee that. You know, we're experimenting again with young people with complete disregard for the cost, and that's very concerning.
This is Life Matters on ABC Radio National. I'm Tegan Taylor speaking with Scott Waters, who's the CEO and founder of Life Changer, a youth mental health service, and Professor Jeannie Patterson, who's the co-director for the Centre for AI and Digital Ethics at the University of Melbourne. Kate in Barrie says, I often copy and paste terse text exchanges with my husband into ChatGPT and ask it to tell me what's really going on for him or why I'm being unreasonable. It's very helpful in taking the temperature down and seeing old arguments in new ways. Kate says, I'm always wary and careful to make sure I don't use it to entrench my point of view. Its sycophantic tendencies are dangerous in my experience. Jeannie, that's a really interesting use. We've got someone using the AI to kind of help with an in-person relationship.
Yeah, it is an interesting use, and I have a PhD colleague, a student who's doing a PhD who used to talk about the possibility of doing much the same thing. You know, sort of a sounding board about what was happening in their personal relationships, and that's fine. That's perfectly fine, and your users identified the sycophantic tendencies of GPT. But I guess my comment would be that a person can become more and more reliant on that sort of interchange, and a GPT has no expertise in this area. And the point I'd add that I think was picked up earlier was that these are models that want to sustain the conversation. So you might start by just sort of playing off conversations and what was happening, and it might be useful or interesting. But if you're someone who is feeling lonely or sad, that might become something you do more and more often. And the tendency of the bot is to prolong the conversation. And what we've learned from people who've done research in this area is that in the short term, engaging with a companion bot or a ChatGPT bot or a generative AI may in fact reduce the symptoms of loneliness. People might feel more connected, more in control of their emotions. But over the longer term, they feel more lonely. Their mental health gets worse because interacting with a sycophantic bot is not the same, to go to the earlier point, as interacting with a person, particularly when it's trying to prolong the conversation, and particularly with some of the companion bots. Very quickly, they're prompting the conversation to go from, how do I think about this conversation, to, would you like to engage in explicitly sexually aggressive interactions with me, the bot?
I've also got a text here from Deb who says, I use ChatGPT to ask some questions I felt uncomfortable to discuss with people. It not only acknowledged my concerns in a non-judgmental way, but explained what's happening. I wouldn't use it as a companion as such, but asking questions people aren't comfortable talking about. The positivity culture we live in makes it hard to talk about death, perhaps. Grieving over loss of sexuality as we age. They're just two examples that Deb says I found useful. She says, I did try to raise these conversations with humans, but they were very, very uncomfortable. I'll definitely use it again. Well, also with me is social media content creator Mia Anastasia, who says she uses ChatGPT a bit like a female friend. Mia, what kind of conversations are you having?
Hi. I kind of just use it for lots of different things. Like, I wouldn't call it a friend, but it can kind of give that blanket effect. Obviously, human relationships are always the priority, and I think that they should be for everyone. But still, like, you kind of have access to this thing that, you know, you can kind of, sometimes you don't want to burden your friends with so much information or a little rant. And sometimes to just get things off your chest, I do think in that way it can be helpful. Obviously, you need to set boundaries and kind of hold your ground with how far you get with it. But I do think it can be very helpful, especially in this day and age and how expensive therapy can be. I do think that it is useful.
Sure. So you're not wanting to burden your real friends, your human friends with your problems, but you can kind of vent?
I always tell my friends everything, but like someone said before, like sometimes like there's things you don't want to talk about with people, and like you kind of have access to something that you can kind of get off your chest, because I don't think bottling things up is also beneficial for your mental health either.
So, Scott, you're working with young people. You've got three sons in their teens and 20s as well. We're hearing from Mia there. It sounds like she's got a pretty good handle on what she needs from the chatbot and what she doesn't need. Are we kind of getting too hand-wringing a bit here?
I think, you know, if you walk into any classroom in Australia, let's take a typical state or private school, 15 years of age, 30 kids in a classroom. Within that classroom, there's young people that are thriving. There is young people that are facing significant challenges. There's a broad cross-section. I think the risk here is our most vulnerable in that classroom are going to be the most vulnerable. So those who are struggling potentially with social cues or emotional regulation, you know, and particularly young boys who haven't really developed, or they're high risk takers at a young age, but also probably have impulse control maturity challenges also. So when they're presented with challenges, retreating and replacing those relationships with a companion relationship in a bot, to me, it is a huge challenge. If it's a balanced, I love the idea of ChatGPT, GPT, or bots being there, putting information in, having a sounding board, getting information back out. But when it starts to replace that physical social relationship, I think we run the risk. Most parents that we talk to now, their biggest challenge is making sure that young people are still engaging with social connections outside of the digital space. So I think if this replaces that, if this takes more time away from the physical relationship, I think that's going to be very challenging. The opportunity here for government is to incentivize tech companies to create age-appropriate spaces for young people, but not run this experiment without high-level compliance, governance. And before we unleash this on the public, that's the question, because there's already many anecdotes and stories, very real, where this has led to tragedy. So I just think it's time to pause and for this to be more regulated before we take more risks.
Jeannie, what guardrails would you like to see?
What I'd like to see is so I'm going to say I liked Mia's example of sort of using, and indeed the one before, using a chatbot as a sounding board. It tells us that can be really useful. But the comment I'm going to make is that ChatGPT is a for-profit tool, they haven't made any money out of it yet, which is trained on the content of the internet. So I'm not entirely sure that's the best sounding board in the long term, particularly for the young people Scott's mentioned. I'd actually like to see more thought put into developing tools that are appropriate for young people, that fulfil the role that's perhaps lacking of that sounding board, that place that people can go for anonymous advice. But the tools are developed by specialists, mental health specialists, like Scott, because I just don't think that a thing that's either trained on the wide internet or has been developed to sustain conversations in order to earn more money for the person that's made it available are the best place for young people to seek advice and support.
Jeannie, Scott and Mia, thank you all so much for joining me. Professor Jeannie Patterson is co-director for the Centre for AI and Digital Ethics at the University of Melbourne. Scott Waters is CEO and founder of the youth mental health service Life Changer. And you also heard from Mia Anastasia, who uses ChatGPT a little bit like a female friend. Well, that's it for Life Matters today on ABC Radio National, coming to you from Jagera and Turrbal Land. Tomorrow, we're going to continue the conversation surrounding AI, specifically AI in schools. What constitutes cheating nowadays? can catch up on any of the stories from Life Matters on the ABC Listen app. Just search for Life Matters. I'll catch you tomorrow.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.